the reality of the soul is sanctified and purified above matter and material things. But like under the world of vision, it manifests itself in these material forms and visages. Likewise, in the psychic condition, one beholds the spirits like under the physical forms and visages. To be brief, the holy souls have great influence and intense effect, and their influence and continuity do not depend upon physical existence and elemental composition. Two kinds of vision. One is spiritual vision and one is vision in the psychic condition. In both of these, at times people imagine that they see other souls or souls that have passed away as if they were physical, present with them. You'll have people swear they saw. You know, they say ghosts or whatever. They say they saw so-and-so in the flesh. They came back and they spoke and they said something to them. Then they disappeared again. But the master is sanctified from material forms. We behold them with an eye of vision, similar to the way we behold forms in dreams. There is no physical form we're beholding, yet we're beholding something very real and we see it perfectly clear. Yes. This is published in the Star of the West, Volume 2, page 6, from a tablet. Maybe we could spend most of the evening talking about this, I think. Then the fact that holy souls have great influence, we've already read about that in different ways, the influence that sanctified souls have on this world, how they are the animating spirit, in a sense. They are the means of the appearance of the arts and the sciences in this world. So obviously the human spirit has some means of being receptive to the influence of this higher kingdom. Sometimes, most of the time, we don't identify our inspirations and thoughts with something separate from ourselves. They have the appearance of arising within our own consciousness. This is another tablet, and this has been translated by Shoghi Effendi before the commencement of his guardianship. Communication and connection between the sons and daughters of the kingdom are not conditioned upon material links. Spiritual means have ever existed and will continue to exist. As, for instance, throughout all these years of commotion, when ways were barred and doors of communication closed, notwithstanding this, hearts were attracted and gladdened by the fragrances of God. Now, I think we're talking about the warriors. This must be a tablet after that, because Shoghi Effendi was also in the service of the master as a translator after the war, or towards the end of the First World War. And there was a time where there were no tablets coming and going, no communications back and forth with the believers. He says, notwithstanding this, hearts were attracted and gladdened by the fragrances of God. Now, you see that if the fragrances of God were something that arise in one's own heart spontaneously, all right, then what would be the point of this? The point of this is that Abdu'l-Bahá is the source of bounty and the distributor of the fragrances of God in this world. And the believers remained, those who were faithful to him, turned to him, they remained recipients of these favors, in the same way that we remain recipients of Baha'u'llah's favors and Abdu'l-Bahá's favors now, if we turn to them. Then he says, praise be to God, thou hast acquired a long and spiritual lineage, and this is by far the most blessed of all lines. For material lines of descent may either be greatly praiseworthy or mean in character, while spiritual lineage is the offspring of the heart and of the soul, and is in every respect praiseworthy. Do you know what your Baha'i spiritual lineage is? Who taught you the faith? Who taught the person that taught you the faith? who taught them the faith. It's interesting. There may be multiple links. There may be several people that assisted in bringing you to awareness in the cause. You may have been born a Baha'i, but you may have had a teacher that had been quickened by somebody that quickened you after years that you've been a Baha'i, but added something to that, made it real for you. Now, what do you think? Do you have any comments about these?
Well, it's interesting, he complimented the person on having acquired a spiritual lineage. He is referring to Thompson.
Well, I'm presuming that he is. Perhaps who is complaining to the master about none of my family are Baha'is and they won't become Baha'is, and he says, oh, praise be to God, thou hast acquired a spiritual lineage now. It doesn't matter, you know, about this material one that's not producing the fruits that you want. It's separated. It's a different part of the tablet from the first part that ends in the fragrances of God. It's a separate section. This is in Star of the West, Volume 10, page 41. And another excerpt from a tablet of the Master. Again, he says, thou canst correspond with thy father and thy niece, but through spiritual means, not material, because the spirits have communication with each other. But this effect is spiritual, not a material meeting, for the purpose of conversing with each other. For instance, to see a departed soul sitting with another, holding his hand and embracing him, is pure imagination. But as the spirits are attached to each other, it is possible for one to acquire spiritual emotions. And this is like unto one who in a world of dreams meets his friends and converses with them. Now, there have been lots of allusions to this, the fact that you can feel spiritually close to loved ones who have passed on. Not that you are perceiving a stream of verbal commentary or you're understanding some conversation from them. Just this communion of feeling close with them and feeling that your grandparents or your mother or your father or one of your friends who've passed on are thinking of you at the same time you're thinking of them. You get this confirmation that you pray for them at Bhaji and you feel that they're close, grateful, or perhaps they're praying for you at the same time. There's no way of confirming or not confirming these things, but they feel good and you say, well, it's fine, and you're happy to rejoice in their closeness if they are, and if not, then you're rejoicing in the closeness of God, because something's close because you're feeling different and better than you do normally, so something's going on. Abdul Baha in Paris talks. Question was asked, can a departed soul converse with someone still on earth? Abdul Baha said, a conversation can be held, but not as our conversation. There is no doubt that the forces of the higher worlds interplay with the forces of this plane. The heart of man is open to inspiration. This is spiritual communication. As in a dream, one talks with a friend while the mouth is silent, so it is in the conversation of the spirit. A man may converse with the ego within him, saying, may I do this? Would it be advisable for me to do this work? Excuse me. Such as this is conversation with the higher self. Then when Abdul Baha was in London, it's a popular theme, wherever he went, people were asking him about communications with the dead. When you do not know it and are in a receptive attitude, they are able to make suggestions to you if you are in difficulty. I've got the answer to this problem. Where did you get it from? I just thought it up. I'm so smart. Is it always that way? We're saying our prayers, we're asking for the removal of difficulties, we're asking for solutions, and then we get solutions. Are we at all conscious that maybe we had help with these problems? I mean, maybe we got these solutions from somewhere other than the combination of our idle thoughts, sticking one to the other and coming out with something new. I don't know, I became a Baha'i after I left school, so.
I think so. I used to say Albert Einstein. Never helped me. I felt helped.
Not wanting to bother the master with your school exams. When you do not know it and one and are in a receptive attitude, they are able to make suggestions to you if you are in difficulty. This sometimes happens in sleep, but there is no phenomenal intercourse. That which seems like phenomenal intercourse has another explanation. The questioner then exclaimed to Abdu'l-Bahá, "But I've heard a voice." Abdu'l-Bahá said, "Yes, that is possible. We hear voices clearly in dreams. It is not with the physical ear that you heard. The spirit of those that have passed on are freed from sense life and do not use physical means. It is not possible to put these great matters into human words. The language of man is the language of children. And man's explanation often leads astray." Page 98 of Abdu'l-Bahá in London. I'm taking all these various hints, seeing by laying one over the other whether we see some common patterns and things we can understand. This is an extract from the diary of Shoghi Effendi when he was in the master's service. And it's been cited in an article on spiritual communication, which was published then in Star of the West, Volume 10, issue 18 of that volume, page 336, June 6th. "Is it possible for those who have sacrificed their lives so freely on the battlefield to communicate with their relatives and kindred from the world beyond?" Again, this question arose because of so many dead in the war. The epitome of Abdu'l-Bahá's reply was as follows. "This spiritual communication and mutual exchange of thoughts is conditioned upon certain facts that prepare the person in this world to communicate with the spirit of his departed ones." Now, you'll find this reference, this concept coming out later in Shoghi Effendi's letters. He heard it from the master, you know. It's engraved on his soul. And he's talking about the prerequisites for communication with the souls in the other world. He says, "A clear mind, a pure heart, and a concentrated attention are the requisites for that spiritual intercommunication." What are the three? Clear mind, a pure heart, and a concentrated attention. "Like unto a mirror, man's heart and mind must be purified, clarified, and polished. Any dust or rust that may be on it, such as attachment to this nether world, the turning of man's face away from God, sin or lust, animosity and rancor, all these must be removed that the rays of the Sun of Truth may shine upon it in full splendor and may be reflected therefrom with full effulgence. If such state or condition is attained, communication with the world above will be made possible. Purity of purpose and concentration with prayer are the essential requisites. Purity of purpose, purity of intention, purity of purpose, and concentration with prayer or through prayer are the essential requisites. Now, if we don't feel the effulgence of the rays of the Sun of Truth shining in their full effulgence within our hearts, then we can be sure we have some of these problems that are listed here, because those are the things that dirty the mirror. So let us see what we need to work on here. We have to be detached from the netherworld. We have to turn our faces towards God. We have to leave behind sin and lust, animosity and rancor. Do we harbor upsets with other people in our hearts? Do we have desires for things other than God? Do we put the love of people before the love of the manifestation? These are the things the Master says that keep the dust on the surface of the mirror and don't allow for a complete full reflection in our being of this light that's constantly beamed on us from Baha'u'llah. He says it's never ceasing. These blessings of the Divine Spirit that flow through the manifestation of God in the invisible world and when he was in this world, he said they never cease raining. The grace of God is never... If it stopped, he said, for an instant, we'd all die. We'd all be annihilated. Being the recipients of incalculable outpourings of Divine Spirit at every instant, the only thing that holds us back are these veils, this dust, this rust, as he says. In other words, we don't have to pray that God does his part. He gives us prayers to pray all the time that we're asking him to do his part. But this is the way he gets us to focus, concentrate our attention, and try to detach ourselves from the world, and try to face ourselves towards him. He gives us these prayers to say. And he blames himself, you know. Oh God, please send down upon me thy healing. It's there all the time. It's just, can we open ourselves to it? Joan, please. Attachment to this netherworld, the turning of one's face away from God, sin or lust, animosity and rancor. All these must be removed, that the rays of the Sun of Truth may shine upon it, upon the heart in full splendor, and may be reflected therefrom with full effulgence. Star of the West, Volume 10, Issue 18, page 336. Volume 10, Issue 18, page 336. Mm-hmm. I think it's, again, examining the teachings, looking to the teachings, because if we're becoming aware, you know, of the truth of the faith, all right, we say, here's the faith of God. It's called the guidance of God. It guides human souls to their destiny. Here am I, I'm a creature, in need of this guidance and this blessing. Nothing else, he tells us, on the face of the earth of any sort compares with it. So I have to make up my mind somehow to give myself to this guidance, to open myself to this guidance. And then I have to seek that all my motives and actions conform to the guidance that flows through the revelation. So if I'm going to school, that's no longer important to me. What's important to me is to do what Baha'u'llah wants. What does Baha'u'llah say he wants? He wants me to know him and to worship him. He wants me to give up all things for him. And then in fine print he says he wants me to acquire knowledge of all arts and sciences. Now I'm going to go to school for Baha'u'llah's sake, because this is a commandment of Baha'u'llah. And I'm going to acquire perfections in this, because the Master says the Baha'i should acquire perfections in what they embark upon, what they endeavor. And because he has asked me to do this, I will do it. And because he's asked me to do it, I will cling to his mercy and his kindness, and I'll ask his assistance and his confirmation so that I can do it in a way that will be pleasing unto him. He says that he wants my heart, my whole heart and being, all of my love, that no love should come before him. Down here in the fine print it says, marry, O people. I need a spouse. Then he tells us the conditions. You know, you should be attracted, you should have affection for each other, you should have common goals. Now, if I can find someone who's also put Baha'u'llah's will before everything else, then they'll also be looking for a spouse. That should help the process. Meanwhile, the other people are prowling around in the world with lusts and longings and desires and everything. They want to fulfill their passions and so on. That's a different scenario altogether from the Baha'i who's looking around, you know. I used to look with this interested eye. Now I look with a new eye. But fortunately, it comes out all right. You get the family, you get the education, you get... Now, Abdu'l Baha says that he wants for us spiritual maturity. So we're seeking spiritual maturity. And then we find in the fine print again, it says, when man has reached spiritual maturity, he requires wealth in order to be of service, so that his philanthropy will demonstrate the bounty of God and the goodness of God, the bestowals of God. So this is acceptable within that context. But he also says, content thyself with whatever we have ordained for thee. So we don't know if we're one of those that's going to demonstrate the blessings of God in poverty or in riches. And everything else takes its point of departure from the writings. It isn't that we have our lives, we have our activities, we have our jobs, we have our families, and we have our religion. All of them lined up like ducks, you know. This one is, which I've got a good religion, thank goodness. And then I've got these other things over here. You know, all of them have to come together. Religion becomes the centerpiece, the guidance of Baha'u'llah. And then everything we find, where does it fit? And if we don't find it fitting, it doesn't fit, then we shouldn't have anything to do with it. We should separate ourselves from it. You know? Then our lives become unified. Our direction is one. And also it becomes one with all the other believers. Because that's the direction that all of us should be taking. And of course then Baha'u'llah is the center of that. So we all move towards that center. As we move towards that center, we become increasingly more united. We become even as one soul in many bodies. We become the expression of his, the collective expression of his love and his wisdom and his beauty. The human race becomes elements of his and reflections of his image. And we all get excited with each other. But that's all right too. He says we should long for each other, like thirsty ones in the desert longing for water. But that comes after loving God above all things, not before. Then apart from that, you have to guess a lot. since we don't manage to center our wills wholly on Baha'u'llah's purpose, we kind of mix our motives with other things, you know, and we see good. We have a dear friend that's gone pioneering someplace. They write us letters and like that. We say, I should pioneer there too. Because, well, Baha'u'llah says to pioneer. The House of Justice calls us to pioneer. Let me go pioneer there too, because I want to pioneer. Maybe, who knows, maybe we'll get married or something. We got all these things in our minds, you know. Glad my wife isn't here tonight. I was pioneering in Nicaragua and she moved to Honduras, which is right next door, and we finally got married. Anyhow, we try to get sincere as we can be. Abdu'l-Bahá says in one of his talks, he said that God is able to even make the mistakes of the sincere ones into advantages for the cause. Their mistakes and their errors, he can use them for the advantage of the cause. He does that for us. In one of the prayers for the fast, we accept all those things we have done for love of thee and all those things we have left undone because of our attachment to our lower selves. He says, accept those things too. We go to the shrine of Baha'u'llah and we think, now what can I offer to Baha'u'llah? And you review everything and you can't really find anything, you know, except a whole lot of shortcomings. You say, well, how I could offer these? I hereby offer all my shortcomings. Please accept them and keep them. Destroy them if you want, but keep them. Don't give them back to me, please. The fast, we're doing that. What was the question again? Again, Mr. and Mrs. Hannon were here in Haifa in 1909, and someone asked, can we communicate with the spirits of the departed? The master said, there is a communication between spirits, but the spiritual seances, as given in Europe, where spirits are supposed to move objects and so on, are phantasmagoria. Phantasmagoria, you spell it N-O-N-S-E-N-S-E. Phantasmagoria. Very good. That spirit can communicate with spirit is proven by the known fact of teaching. He gives an interesting example here. That spirit can communicate with spirit is proven by the known fact of teaching. It is a self-evident fact that nothing tangible passes from the teacher to the pupil, yet ideas are conveyed. In point of fact, the human mind is in the original state, non-individualistic, and the teacher individualizes knowledge by classifying it and locating it with respect to the pupil's mind. The human mind is in the original state, non-individualistic. And the teacher individualizes knowledge by classifying it and locating it with respect to the pupil's mind. Now you think how you learn about, when you learn about species and the geological ages of the earth and all these various things, there's a whole realm of knowledge there which you begin to be able to relate to by organizing it, by classifying it in some way. The manifestation comes, we're faced, it's like children's vision, they don't distinguish things clearly. But gradually they come to know and identify things and give names to things and understand them in this way. and build upon that until the semblance of a world is constructed around them. This seems to be what the Master is saying. One wonders, because the pilgrim knows just how it got communicated and how it got translated and so on. But this is a self-evident fact, he said. The conveyance of knowledge from one spirit to another by teaching.
That he says that the mind is not individualistic. Does that mean that we have a mind together or individual mind?
I don't know exactly what he means by that. Does somebody have an idea?
Because I have read in the writings, Baha'u'llah, that he says that before all else, he created mind. I don't know exactly where, but I'll probably look it up. And I don't really... kind of relate to each other.
You know, before all else, he says, we created will. But then the Master says that first will is the same as what the philosophers call first mind. And so it's very closely related to the idea of a mind, of will, of purpose, of understanding, the ability to comprehend. He talks about universal mind in some answered questions. And how a ray of that falls upon the heart of the righteous. In other words, we again, this idea that the human heart is a mirror, and if it's cleansed and it's faced the right direction, it will reflect the brightnesses of the manifestation of God and His knowledge, the forms of His understanding, so to speak, are communicated spiritually. So he says that he does this, passes this knowledge by classifying it and locating it with respect to the pupil's mind. So soul can communicate with soul, and in the realms of existence, such intercommunication is possible. Maybe further quotations will throw more light on this. This is an entry in the diary of one of the Master Secretaries. He says, then the question of spiritual communication was asked. And Abdu'l-Bahá answered, yes, it is possible. Often people speak together without the means of tongue. There are two means of intercourse, one the outward tongue, the other the ideal tongue. When the spirit is in an abstract mood, when the heart is in a subjective state, then the ideal tongue can speak. But as long as the spirit is preoccupied and the heart is objective in its activity, it is impossible to attain to that station. Consider, is there not an ideal union between the loved one and the beloved? Often with a glance of the eye or a handshake, a whole world of thought is conveyed without uttering a word. It is possible to attain to such a state if we are set aglow with the fire of the love of God, if we are attracted, if we are as a burning torch, if we overlook material phenomena and objects. So we have this condition of prayer and meditation where we abstract ourselves from the things of the world. We commune in a non-specific way with this light and presence of the manifestation.
I don't think I understand what is meant by a subjective tongue.
One that is not occupied with objective things, I think is what, by the reverse definition, you can come to see what he's talking about.
Like emotion? I think of it like emotion versus rational thought, but I don't think that's what it means.
I don't think that's what's meant. No, it's like whether it's you're concentrating. You know, it's like when you want to say a prayer and you're saying the prayer, but you're also thinking about the laundry is going to, the machine is going to finish, and I got to get down there. Let me finish this prayer. And then you find out do I have enough money to get the bus after I do that? And, you know, every time you start to think about something spiritual, some other thought comes in and impinges on it. Now, in order to partake of the prayer in the spirit that we're supposed to, one has to free oneself from extraneous thoughts, from all these impinging concerns that are real concerns, but they're at another level. This is why the master suggests praying at midnight or at dawn. You know, because there are times when we're not so immediately concerned with all these other things, you know. We don't have somebody waiting downstairs in the lunchroom, so we say our noon prayer as fast as we can so we can get down there. Or any other circumstance, whatever it is. Do we take time to really get in a state of prayer? Now, I think all of us know about that. There are times when we feel our prayers connect somehow, or we feel the closeness of Baha'u'llah. It doesn't mean a lot of praying necessarily, although sometimes it means a lot of praying. Sometimes it means just sticking with repeating the words of the prayers until finally you drive the other thoughts out. And that's usually recommended, to say the prayers out loud when you're having trouble concentrating particularly. After your concentration is established, then when you begin to get in this state of detachment, where you let these words operate on you, so to speak, and reveal themselves to you, and energize you, then you don't have to say them out loud necessarily. Maybe you'll come to a point where you've been chanting and you finally don't chant it. You read the tablet instead. You move quickly through the tablets. Or you stop and you savor a long time. It doesn't matter whether you're speaking with the outer tongue or not. But the use of the body and the outward tongue, the attitude of prayer, proper physical attitude of prayer, and using the speech of prayer, helps one to concentrate. Now, it's in this condition, Abdu'l-Bahá says, where we're more likely to receive the influx of the thoughts of those who are in that condition all the time. That is, the souls of the departed, the souls of the other realm. Yes, yes, it's a wonderful prayer, because then you don't have so much discursive thought going on, because all the other prayers have some kind of discursive explanation being given as you're reading the prayer. Now, this is the thing about chanting, where you have music as well as the words. It's like a song. It has the music and it has the words, the letters, the notes and words of the song, the lyrics. Sometimes you listen to the lyrics and you're inspired by the lyrics. Sometimes the melody carries you away. The music of it carries you away. Both are effective, Abdu'l-Bahá says. Now, if we just read our prayers, well, it's different. Maybe sometimes when you're alone, even if you're reading in English, you find you want to sing a prayer. You want to. What the ancients used to call in this country, psalm of prayer. We don't have that verb, I think, in English. But you do have it in the Latin languages. You have a word, a verb, salmiar, which is a kind of an intonation of the prayer, which is neither reading it nor is it chanting it. It's giving some rhythm to the speech, independent of the meaning of the words. So that it's a kind of, at worst it's a drone, at best it's an intoning, so to speak. Somebody wanted to ask something, please. Oh yes, I mean, then you're receptive to everything. But you'll be open mainly to the light of the truth of the manifestation, because whatever the light of these detached souls radiating towards you from them is from Baha'u'llah. I mean, it's from the manifestation of God that they have light. And that's what we enjoy from each other too. That which we benefit from each other is the effect of Baha'u'llah in each of us, so to speak. The effect of the great spirit, the divine spirit of Baha'u'llah. This is the way I understand it anyway. So that has this, there'll be many, it's compounded, in other words, of the influence of many sources. But sometimes you may feel particularly closer or concentrated on some dear one or loved one. Or maybe sometimes you feel close to the Bab and another time close to Baha'u'llah and another time close to Abdu'l-Bahá. Or maybe you address the greatest holy leaf or whatever you feel moved at times to do. But The question is to allow oneself enough time to pray and meditate in that quiet state, and to reflect on one's own problems and questions and issues of the teachings and one's spiritual life in such a state, rather than always being in a hurry and filling up our lives with all kinds of activities and that keep us from ever having to go into that condition, unless we become ill, and when we're ill we don't communicate very well spiritually anyway. So you've got other veils that are a problem, you know. You've all heard that Phil Sears used to say this over and over. He said it here at the convention. He said, if you don't feel as close to God now as you did last year, who moved? Did God go away? This is this idea that confirmation is always there. Why is it God is not near us? Why has He left me alone now? I don't know, you know. I used to feel close to Baha'u'llah, but I think He's busy with all the new Baha'is or something. This isn't the way. This isn't the case, he says. It's constantly in the world of the Spirit, He's shining on us. Question, can disembodied souls communicate with embodied ones? Master says, yes, but they do not do it through mediums or material ways, but in spiritual ways. This is cited in the Star of the West from a tablet and an editorial. From a tablet in an editorial entitled Psychic Forces. And these notes were made from the words of Abdu'l-Bahá when he was in America in 1912. Later, a copy of the notes was submitted to Abdu'l-Bahá in August 1914 by Mrs. Hoag, Emma Jean Hoag. While she was in Haifa, the notes as quoted are a copy of the corrected copy. To tamper with psychic forces while in this world interferes with the condition of the soul in the world to come. These forces are real, but are not to be active on this plane. The child in the matrix has its eyes, ears, hands, and feet, but these powers are not in activity. The whole purpose of the matrix life is the coming into the world. So the whole purpose of the matrix world life, in other words, this life, is coming forth into the world of reality, where all those forces will become active. They belong to that world. Now this tells us this is very active. There's a psychic world, it's a very active world. And we will use these forces in a normal course of existence in the future. But we shouldn't try to tamper with them here, try to employ them, try to play with them. And if they appear in us spontaneously, we should disregard them, not pursue them, not develop them. Now we have to understand that we are seeking spiritual forces and spiritual development, but not psychic forces. What's the difference? How do we understand the difference? In that problem rests some of the spiritual suspension of the believers, because some of them have understood that any kind of concentration, like prayer or meditation, where you try to abstract yourself from the things of the outside world and concentrate on the blessings and spiritual presence of Baha'u'llah, so to speak, is like as if you're using psychic forces again. Yes? Yes. I don't think that the psychic seems to be more in the realm of telepathy and telecommunication and the kind of things that mediums purport to do, you know, or the material realization of trying to make things out of nothing by mental forces and things of this sort. I think this is what's generally explained in the religious teachings of the past to us, psychic forces. I don't know, I wouldn't want to say how it applies to vision quest of the Native Americans, which seem to be, has a much higher character and is connected with fasting and prayer and putting oneself again in this abstract condition so that one might wait for a vision. I mean, you can't produce the vision, but you at least are receptive to it. I don't know how it works. It's not the form that's given in the Baha'i writings, although we're told to meditate and we're given powerful prayers to repeat. The Bab has prescribed some prayers which you say 1,000 times in one sitting, you know. There are such things. What effective it will be to free you from your troubles and so on. You were going to add something, please. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very delicate area. I mean, you can't say what they should do and shouldn't do, but if they're Baha'is, then the question arises, you know, how much to participate. The Sundance, for instance, has a ceremony where you pierce the chest and hang, the warrior is hung up on a, in the sun, in the center of the Sun Lodge, and hangs there for a while. And should Baha'is, or do Baha'is need such an experience? No. It becomes an interesting question about Baha'u'llah has removed the rituals and ceremonies of the past. He's assigned certain ones, and the rest he's left behind. So there's some things that, I mean, some of the dances and some of the other things that seem more acceptable within as cultural expressions, maybe spiritual cultural expressions, but it's hard to know just where do you draw the line. Right? This is this question that arises now. The whole Native American church is based on the use of peyote. And they say that there's not a drug, it's like a medicinal thing that they use to cleanse themselves, to prepare them, connect themselves with the Great Spirit. And yet the Baha'i teachings condemn all forms of hallucinogenics and drugs of that nature. So there's a conflict there. So that the Native Americans who become Baha'is have to resolve these questions. Have you heard discussions on the same? I'm sure you have.
Is it? Dr. Garber, who was here from the Soviet Union visiting the World Center last month, one of his areas of study was shamans and also Tibetan priests and meditators, and studying the physiological conditions of these individuals when they were in states of deep meditation or when they were in the act of healing or so on. And they identified, I don't remember all the technical names, John knows the technical names of the things that are released in the bloodstream or something,
the same type of things that are released in the bloodstream of these individuals in these conditions are the same type of things, in some cases, that are released by hallucinogenics, by drugs. There is a parallel condition induced by these. And he was talking about the power of healing that comes from thinking healing, you know. And actually they have clinical studies to develop this, to see how much the thought has an influence and prayer has an influence. He says it's definitely proven prayer has a powerful influence in the well-being and healing of the human body. Now this is a Soviet who doesn't have a religion, says he's an atheist, but I mean, they've been more forward in their studies in these areas than we have been in the West, where we have so-called religionalism. We say it's religion, say this and that, but we more or less don't take it very seriously. But they saw that there were some powers in this. They want to know what powers there are. Are there powers that the state should know about in such things? You know? Not to prove religion, but to see of powers that are part of the human reality, which can be used in the service of society, directed or misdirected or whatever, but still that are there to be tapped.
You asked the question, what is the difference between using psychic forces and spiritual forces? And the few things that were mentioned to differentiate the two were under psychic forces, telepathy, ritual, ceremony, and hallucinogenics. And under spiritual forces, things like meditation, prayer, and being in a receptive state. And I'm trying to meet that the areas are still, there still is some ambiguity between.
There is definitely lots of ambiguity. That's just it. It depends on your motive, first of all. The psychic is usually, you know, for some personal advantage. I mean, people, you want to read people's thoughts, or you want to impress upon them, or you want to foretell future events. You want access to certain things that you don't really need access to. I mean, you say, God is going to guide me. I pray to God. I put my affairs in His hand. But instead of this, I want to see around the corner and see what's coming. Deal with it in some way, you know. Ouija boards and automatic writing, trying to get spirits to help us, to guide us to messages on Ouija boards and things like that. But I do get messages, and they're, I mean, great messages, you know.
But why is it so bad to forecast?
Is it bad to forecast?
I don't think so. I hope not.
That's not what I'm saying. I don't. I mean, I hope I'm not saying that. I'm saying this.
It's like a forecast, to not try to forecast by using psychic forces rather to forecast using really logical
trends and things of that sort. These are legitimate. That's different, I think, from employing psychic forces to figure out something. I don't know. There's a whole list of psychic activities, psychic practices, you know, ESP and clairvoyance and all these different powers which do appear at times in this world. But Abdu'l-Bahá says don't entertain them, I mean don't pursue them, so to speak.
Providing an answer themselves, looking to be told what to do.
Well, I think same Bushmen, also native peoples, many places. Some also the Native Americans. Well, perceptive about sincerity and things that have to do with how true people are, how true they are in their relations with others, or how true they are in their relationship with God. But that's a generalization, doesn't apply to all the people. Some of them are degenerated to the point where they don't understand and experience such things. Let's go on reading these quotes, because each one of them adds a little something. I mean, obviously we're dealing with things that nobody clearly understands. I don't pretend to understand it either. But you get some pattern, some picture from it. Regarding your question, in his chapter, this is from a letter written on behalf of the Guardian, in his chapter on visions and communications with spirits and some answered questions, the Master evidently desires to point out that there can be, under certain rare circumstances, such as those experienced by the prophets, communion with some soul gone before into the invisible world, but that most of this type of experience, which people often claim to have with departed souls, is nothing but the product of their own imaginations, however real it may seem to them to be. Regarding your question in connection with someone's desire to be informed about table writing and such things, though there is no specific reference in the teachings to this particular thing, Shoghi Effendi feels very strongly that in view of other statements about avoiding all psychic dabbling and exercise of psychic faculties, this should also be avoided by the Baha'is and such messages be disregarded. There is no ambiguity about the Master's attitude towards psychic forces. He very strongly warned the believers against using them. What Abdu'l-Bahá always pointed out in this matter is that these psychic powers were not to be used in this world, and that indeed it was dangerous to cultivate them here. They should be left dormant and not exploited, even when we do so with the sincere belief we are helping others. We do not understand their nature and have no way of being sure of what is true and what is false in such matters. If children are inclined to be psychic, they should not be blamed for it too harshly. They should not be encouraged to strengthen their powers in this direction. As regards your question about the members who still cling to psychic practices, he hopes that by now all those who became active in the new center you established have given up attending seances and psychical practices. If they have not, they should do so. And that finishes those particular direct references to psychic practices. Now we come into the question of more on visions and dreams themselves. This is from a tablet of the Master. He says, "Thou didst ask as to the transfiguration of Jesus with Moses and Elias and the Heavenly Father on Mount Tabor, as referred to in the Bible. This occurrence was perceived by the disciples with their inner eye, wherefore it was a secret hidden away and was a spiritual discovery of theirs. Otherwise, if the intent be that they witnessed physical forms, that is, witnessed that transfiguration with their outward eyes, then there were many others at hand on that plain and mountain. And why did they fail to behold it? And why did the Lord charge them that they should tell no man? It is clear that this was a spiritual vision and a scene of the kingdom. Wherefore did the Messiah bid them to keep this hidden till the Son of Man were risen from the dead? That is, until the cause of God should be exalted and the word of God prevail and the reality of Christ rise up. Selections from the Writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 162. I don't know, it's got into the Gospels, and that's where we see it. Well, they were compiled and published about 300 years after Christ. It's about the time of Constantine's conversion. That truth is often imparted through dreams. No one, this is Shoghi Effendi, letter on behalf of Shoghi Effendi. That truth is often imparted through dreams, no one who is familiar with history, especially religious history, can doubt. At the same time, dreams and visions are always colored and influenced more or less by the mind of the dreamer, and we must beware of attaching too much importance to them. The purer and more free from prejudice and desire our hearts and minds become, the more likely is it that our dreams will convey reliable truth. But if we have strong prejudices, personal likings and aversions, bad feelings or evil motives, these will warp and distort any inspirational impression that comes to us. In many cases, dreams have been the means of bringing people to the truth or of confirming them in the faith. We must strive to become pure in heart and free from all save God. Then our dreams, as well as our waking thoughts, will become pure and true. We should test impressions we get through dreams, visions, or inspirations by comparing them with the revealed word and seeing whether they are in harmony therewith. So that's your standard. May 16th, 1925. I think it's been published in... the first book of compilations that the Indian Publishing Trust put out has some of these compilations that the House of Justice published. One of them is on dreams and psychic powers and visions and things. And this is printed there. It is in print, circulated. And I think it's probably been put into Lights of Guidance. You could check those two sources. This one's out of a file at the World Center. Regarding your question relative to the condition of those people who are described in the Gospel as being possessed of devils, this should be interpreted figuratively. Devil or Satan is symbolic of evil and dark forces yielding to temptation. This question oftentimes arises with Christians. The devil made me do it. Evil and dark forces yielding to temptation. First, concerning visions, it's very difficult to distinguish between true visions, which are true spiritual experiences of the soul, and imaginations, which have no reality in spiritual truths. True visions, however, can be granted to those who are spiritually pure and receptive and are not, therefore, confined to the prophets alone. The Guardian thinks that it is best to assume that, generally speaking, when people claim they are receiving messages or communications from the Master or Baha'u'llah, it is a psychic experience or their imagination, and that they are not in real contact with them. These holy beings have the channels of the cause through which to guide us. They do not need to go outside these and send individual revelations. So if you think, well, oh, but, you know, so-and-so had a vision, Baha'u'llah is telling us all to do this or that. Well, he has the administrative order, he has a whole series of channels through which he communicates to the believers. These may or may not be helpful guidance to us as individuals, but sometimes they are. We're free to look at them ourselves, you know. And we can tell others about them, but we certainly can't expect others to act on our dreams or visions if we have them. And even, Shoghi Effendi says, we should be cautious about acting on them ourselves. First, we should line them up against the revelation, because he said all these various factors warp and distort the inspiration that comes to the soul, so that one can put one's own meaning on such things and then say, this is Baha'u'llah's will for me, because I have this dream and I understand this to mean this and this to mean that. And find out what it says in the gleanings. Find out what it says in the advent of divine justice. See what the teachings is.
The dream uses a lot of symbology and events that don't bring meaning. So, how would we be able to interpret
well, that's about all we have to depend on. We can pray and ask for guidance for the meaning, to understand the meaning of the dream. Perhaps we'll get some help that way. The master would sometimes interpret the dreams very specifically. Sometimes he would say such and such a thing in a dream means such and such. Then you've got a clue in case you've had those particular symbols. But he talks about three kinds of dreams. One produced by the activities of the day, which is a kind of nervous impressions that continue. You know, you've been working on the word processor all day and you do it all night. Or you've been trimming a hedge and you continue trimming the hedge the rest of the night and you're tired and you wake up in the morning. That's one kind of dream. Then the second kind is this symbolic dreams, where things are expressed in symbols and in parables and things. And one has to somehow work out the meaning of it, discover what the meaning of it is. I remember Dr. J. Carey said, two nights before the guardian died, he had a dream. Shoghi Effendi was standing next to a small table in a room, and there were coins on this table, and he was picking up the coins, a handful of the coins, and he took the coins and he started breaking the coins and dropping the pieces, breaking the coins, dropping the pieces, breaking the coins, dropping the pieces. He was very impressed with this. At breakfast, he told his wife, he said, I've had a dream with Shoghi Effendi. And she said, I did too. I had a dream too. So he asked her, what was your dream? She said, I dreamed that Shoghi Effendi was standing in a room by a table, and it was a pile of plates on that table, and he was taking the plates one at a time and throwing them to the floor and breaking them. Then he told her about the broken coins. And several days later, they heard of the guardian passing. So here you have it. I mean, you know, they found out the meaning. I mean, they could understand somehow the meaning or the hint that they were being given ahead of time.
I think I remember reading in the Seven Valleys. I don't remember which valley it was, of course. I never remember where it was.
It's pretty good if you can remember that it's in the Seven Valleys. That's a start. That's very good.
Well, anyway, he says that the wayfarers in this valley able to understand the specific kind of thing. I don't know, you might remember.
Okay. Fair enough. The third kind of dream is the dream which is a clear dream and is a spiritual disclosure, in which things are quite clear. You see Abdu'l Baha'i comes to you, embraces you, he gives you some juice to drink, he showers his love upon you, or you see one of the spiritual beings, perhaps even the manifestation of God, and it excites and renews your vision. So maybe, if you're privileged. Good luck. It's all right. Do you remember this other letter I read a little before we came to this subject? And he says that for the most part, the experiences of the people who dream, even of the master and the manifestation, these may be their imaginations. So we don't know, you know, it's a question. Even though they seem very real to us. Please. Yes. Okay. Yes, there should be. Of course, these things in the Bible, I remember there's several tablets of the Master where he told the friends, you know, that the meaning of this verse is such and such. He said, but turn to the kingdom and turn your being wholly towards the Lord. And he will supply you, you know, he will provide you with inspiration that you can understand all the symbols of the Bible, that you can expound on all the meanings of the verses of the holy books. So that power is promised there to the soul too. In other words, the same condition we're talking about where one is receptive and can commune with souls beyond and feel the closeness of the manifestation is the same, endows you with an eye with which to look at the scriptures and to derive the hidden meanings and the hidden gift that we read about in the prayers for the fast. But one more quote on this subject and then we'll finish here. Someone has written the Guardian, they're doing automatic writing and some painting, waiting for electric kind of inspirations and then painting things, you know, and so on. So he writes back, this is a very nice believer too, he says, he feels that the methods you are pursuing in regard to receiving inspired written messages and your way of approaching your painting are really psychic and that you should give them up for your own good. Some of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l Baha's tablets are so poorly translated that it is almost impossible to grasp the true meaning, and one is misled into thinking that by getting into a practically psychic state, the Holy Spirit will guide one. This is not what is meant. The world's greatest writers and painters have not been under psychic influence, but through innate ability, practice, and study have given us their masterpieces. This is the normal way for inspiration to reach us, through the channels of our own abilities, and not through control by forces which the Master warned us against, and which we do not understand, and which, as you yourself know, are neither consistent nor reliable. Because the lady wrote that in her letter to the Guardian. So that gives us another way of looking at this thing. I don't know if this is published. I don't believe it's published. If we could take a date on it, it's February 24th, 1947. Well, friends, we see on the breakdown of the topics, there is another subject there on martyrdom, condition of martyrs, mystery of martyrdom. And I never have compiled anything much on that. It was one of the topics that was there that wasn't explored, but I felt should be added to this. But I recommend that we're not going to have a class on that. I recommend that you turn to the latest volume of the Baha'i World, the Crimson Volume. It has a section on the Baha'i sacred writings and has a compilation there from the writings of Baha'u'llah and then from Abdu'l Baha and Shoghi Effendi. All unpublished, previously unpublished tablets and messages about this subject of sacrifice and martyrdom and so on. And it's a thrilling selection of writings that no Baha'i should go without reading. But sometimes, because it's in that volume, not published in a separate book, we don't know it's there and we don't realize that they're nowhere else to be seen. And it was a tremendous work of the research department here and of the House of Justice to prepare these for that volume. What's the name of the Persian compilation that it comes from that was also created here? Narvanur is taken from a Persian compilation that was prepared also by the World Center on this subject. And then the last section is the prayers for the departed. And you can look in your prayer book, you can find those, and there are other sources you can find from time to time. Some of the compilations on immortality have additional prayers. There's a new one now in the prayer book, but it's in the selections from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá on this subject. Now, the next course that we've been planning on for a long time is the study of the Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. And this will be coming up now, and I think, let's see, I want to have a break for a couple weeks and then start that course. So let us say we will begin that course on Sunday night, April 8th. So we'll have a couple Sundays free. 25th and the 1st will be free. And then we'll take up our studies again, for those of you that want to attend that course, starting on April 8th, Sunday, April 8th. Please. Sure. Well, may my life be offered up for thee. May I become a sacrifice at your threshold. May I be a martyr, is one meaning. But within that meaning, I think, is there, may I be a martyr who, will you take me my physical life, because I offer that? Or would you take my living martyrdom, because I offer that? You know, the writings talk about these two kinds. One is living martyrdom and one is giving oneself actually as a physical sacrifice for the cause. In other words, being willing to do that. Not simply a polite phrase. I mean, we're saying, you know, may my soul be offered up. May my spirit be a ransom for the adversities thou didst sustain. He gives us these verses. Now we should see how we can bring our hearts into alignment with that outlook, with the willingness, you know. How do we want to die? I mean, we're going to get old and we're going to get sore and we're going to get cranky and probably feel bad and have certain things ache and maybe certain things rot away inside of us, and then we're going to die in our bed going gargle, gargle, and die. Now, do you want to do that, or would you rather maybe a little before that, while you're still on your feet, be chopped down by some assassin, some persecutor of the cause? Quick, easy, gone, you know, that you've offered yourself. You have, by your blood, you have offered something for the cause. Your sacrifice, the spirit that generates in those around you, because you've given your life for the cause, you haven't denied the cause, you've stood up and you've given your life for the cause, quickens the world and has an effect that throws you also into the supreme concourse. Or you can take your chances. Maybe you'll just fall asleep sometime when you're in your easy chair in front of your television and you'll drift off to the Abba kingdom. Now, what is this? I'm giving this, you know, kind of harsh contrast, because we don't think it through, you know. We think, oh, how could I do that? You know, how could I be killed for the faith? You're going to die anyway. We're all going to die. Let's do it in a really splendid way, you know. I don't know if we have the opportunity. Who knows whether we'll have the opportunity or not. But one could ask. One could meditate and think, and one could ask. No? What does he say in the hidden words? Seek a martyr's death in my path. That's it. That's the one I was thinking about. At least if we're open to that, you know, if we've thought it through, if we've worked it through spiritually, and we're open to it, what are we going to be afraid of? I mean, you know, what can happen to us? And then if you read the story of the martyrs, maybe the pain that they had was just for an instant, and then it was gone. They were relieved of any physical part of this thing. They were ecstatic. They were caught up in the arms of Baha'u'llah. He had come to them and talked to them before they were martyred. All the stories are incredible, the ones that were in prison in Iran and the things they suffered. Anyway, this compilation will give you a feeling for that. You end up, you know, wishing that you were nothing but a martyr. If there was anything you could do, at least I could do that. I could be killed for the cause. You know, I don't seem to live the life very well, and I don't seem to get out and pioneer properly, but maybe just I could just give myself some time. You know?
Thank you.